Good afternoon and welcome to today's Innovative Ideas podcast. My name is Paul Howard and I'm the director and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute's Center for Medical Progress. Our guest today is Derek Lowe. Derek and I will be talking about the FDA's recent decision to revoke Avastin's approval for metastatic breast cancer after a long and sometimes emotional appeal from cancer patients and over the strenuous objections of Avastin's maker, Genentech. Derek Lowe received his BA from Hendrix College and his PhD in organic chemistry from Duke before spending time in Germany on a Humboldt Fellowship. He's also worked for several major pharmaceutical companies since 1989 on drug discovery projects related to schizophrenia, Alzheimer's, diabetes, osteoporosis, and other diseases. He blogs regularly on the pharmaceutical industry and drug discovery weblog In the Pipeline. Derek, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Derek, you've blogged several times over the last few months about the Avastin controversy at the FDA. The FDA on Friday revoked Avastin's approval for metastatic breast cancer after an initial advisory panel voted nearly unanimously to revoke the approval, and then there was an appeal by Genentech, went to the commissioner. The commissioner said, at the end of the day, we have to revoke this approval. Why don't you just start giving us a quick summary of your thinking on this topic?
Sure. Well, it's an interesting process because this was, as you mentioned, a provisional approval. This was not the regular, full-scale, here's all the possible data type of approval that you go in for when a drug is first approved. Cancer is a very fragmented area because there's really no one disease called cancer. There are probably hundreds or thousands of diseases which we all think of as superficially similar. They're uncontrolled cell growth, and we call them cancer, but biochemically, they differ a tremendous amount. So if you're going to get approval in that area, then you come in and you say, all right, I want approval for colorectal cancer or of this exact kind of colorectal cancer or of this exact kind of non-small cell lung cancer or of metastatic breast cancer, as in this case. So Genentech came with provisional data. They had a trial that seemed to show improved treatment of patients. Now, this is the tricky part because they were using a surrogate marker, progression-free survival. That is, does the tumor appear to be growing? Is the actual amount of cancer mass still growing or not? But that's a quicker marker. The real marker that everyone really cares about in cancer is, of course, real survival. How long does it extend a patient's life? It doesn't really matter much if your cancer isn't growing much if you die at the same time. No one really cares. That takes longer to get. So the agency was willing to grant them a provisional approval based on just watching the progression of cancer, with the proviso that they run further studies and keep an eye on overall survival and come back with data on whether or not there was that benefit.
And in this case, the initial studies, for one thing, the progression-free survival either, I think it went from 5 months to 1 month, correct me if I'm wrong, so it went sharply down from what they'd initially
seen. It really did. The first study was by far the one that showed the most promising data. And everything after that just cut into that number.
Right. And then you had no advantage on overall survival, and I think in some instances it actually looked worse.
Right, because Avastin itself is a very strong drug. It's an antibody to a growth factor called VEGF-A, and VEGF-A is pretty ubiquitous. It's in a lot of tissues, and if you come in and knock it down with an antibody, there are going to be effects. Like a lot of cancer drugs, this is the sort of thing that you would pick up with tongs if you didn't have cancer.
Right.
Honestly, you would put on a breathing mask if you didn't have cancer and had to take this stuff.
Right, because the drug inhibits the growth of blood vessels in the body, whether they're
right.
Going to tumors or other parts of your body that are growing blood vessels.
Exactly.
So if you cut all of them off at the same time, obviously you're hitting all those systems. If you've got tumors, obviously you want to do that, but if you know, for those other organ systems, they can be potentially life-threatening.
Exactly. You better not have any sort of internal injury or anything that requires new blood vessel growth while you're taking this, because they're probably not going to grow very well.
So your perspective here is, look, that they came to the FDA with what looked like promising data. They got approval through a program called accelerated approval, which allows drugs to go to market for an indication where you've got promising early data. Then they have to promise to vindicate it in these later studies. Those later studies didn't vindicate the drug. And then so the FDA really, in a way, followed its own rules for accelerated approval.
It did. I think this is exactly how the accelerated approval system is supposed to work. Not all of these things are going to pan out. That's one of the things that you find when you start doing clinical research in the drug field, is that it's really very difficult to get good, solid numbers, and you can be misled at almost every stage. The smaller the trial, the more likely it is that you're being misled. That's where all the time and effort and money come in. And it's really frustrating, especially for people who are looking at this from the outside, and they're saying, well, my gosh, you tested this in people, and it made them better. What's the problem? The problem is that sometimes these effects are just by chance, and it can take a tremendous number of people and a fair amount of time to determine that you're not just fooling yourself. There are just an almost infinite number of ways that you can fool yourself or get fooled.
Right. And I think that, you know, from my perspective, I've been critical of the FDA on other issues, and I think there are a lot of reasons you can be critical in areas where they're risk-averse. But I do think when it comes to AIDS and cancer and some other rare diseases, you can make the case they're actually relatively forward-thinking and do approve drugs more often based on these surrogate markers, as they did for Avastin in this case early on. And so one of my concerns was that if the agency was and it was, under tremendous pressure to leave Avastin on the market, that critics of the agency in the other direction would have said, look, accelerated approval doesn't mean anything because you're putting out drugs that either are useless or harmful to patients. And if you can't pull them back with this data, the program has no value at all. So in a sense, I see this as protecting the accelerated approval pathway for other drugs and for other cancer drugs. What's your thought on that?
No, I agree with that, because if you're going to have a meaningful accelerated approval process, it has to be able to go either way based on the evidence. You have to have some case. There are going to be some cases where you really did the right thing by getting out in front on the early data, but that is definitely not going to happen all the time. In fact, it's probably not going to happen even half the time, especially in an area like cancer where there are just so many variables. So you're going to have to be ready for things to fail, and you're right. If you do not let them fail, then the entire process just becomes a sort of dance, a theatrical presentation, and all it does is waste everyone's time.
Right, and then the danger is that the agency goes back the other way and overreacts and then says, well, we're just not going to approve anything if we can never pull a thing off the market.
Right, and that's the thing. I mean, not everything works. Not everything deserves to keep its approval. If you're going to get out in front of it like this, you just have to be willing to accept that.
Right. And I think, and this is an issue I wrote about on my blog post, I think the interesting thing is, and I know some of this was due to the expectation the FDA was going to change its mind, but I understand that after the studies came out, use of Avastin plummeted for metastatic breast cancer. I think only today 20% of the breast cancer patients who are eligible for Avastin treatment are getting it today versus, I think, something like 60% several months ago. So it seems like the market on its own, or physicians and oncologists, are looking at the data and saying, okay, this is not giving us the benefit we originally thought we had, and it's corrected itself even before the FDA did.
Exactly. People looked at this and they realized what these numbers were saying, and it was pretty clear. This was not something that you had to sit up all night figuring out the implications of. It was clear. People made their decisions on it, and the FDA decision just sort of ratified and formalized what was already happening in the market.
Right.
And I think it's actually a credit to the oncology community that they reacted in the way they did.
Now, just to look at Avastin from a little bit of a further back perspective. The drug is approved, I believe, first of all in 2004 for colorectal cancer.
Colorectal cancer, then it went on with lung cancer and several others. That's the thing about cancer. There are so many indications where you could imagine that shutting down blood vessel growth, shutting down angiogenesis would be good, and they've sort of been running through them one after the other.
Absolutely. But the field of cancer research is moving so rapidly these days. And one example, I was speaking with a researcher from Pfizer a few days ago, and we were talking about the success of their new drug, Xalkori, for a very small slice of lung cancer patients, the 3 to 5% of patients who have this variation in the ALK gene,
right,
the ALK gene. And they said, well, you know, when we first started this trial, we didn't think that ALK was a meaningful progressor for lung cancer. But then this paper came out in Nature Science in 2007 that linked it to lung cancer. We said, let's go back and test the patients. And sure enough, they found a couple of patients who were very high responders who turned out they had this gene. And it changed the whole course of the evolution of the program, allowed the drug, and the FDA noted this in its recent report, to get to market approval under accelerated approval 5 years after human clinical trials had started, which for any indication, for cancer indication, is still breathtakingly fast.
That is very fast. And that, you're right, this is one direction the cancer therapy area is going. The tricky part is finding these targets, these genes that code for these targets that you can target a drug to. So this is a little bit like the Gleevec story, which of course took a lot longer. And this also illustrates how many different diseases cancer is, because you would have to think that this new drug targeting ALK would be completely useless in most cancers, because most of them are not driven by that particular protein. It's not important enough to even slow them down. Some of them probably don't even have a mutation or change in it at all. But for the people who have cancers for which that is the driving force, the real motor behind it, this is going to be a great drug. It's going to be a very small slice, though. So we could end up over time with there being, we should hope, hundreds or even thousands of individualized cancer therapies, each of which will work pretty well on an individual cancer once we figure out what kind it is. I don't know how long this is going to take, but you have to think that's where the field is headed eventually.
And Genentech has already announced it's going to do another phase 3 trial looking, in fact, for these high responders based on a biomarker, I guess something like a super expressor for VEGF-A.
Right.
Do you think, you know, the odds that they're going to find that marker, or is there the possibility that Avastin would be turned into, via better clinical trials, into more of a targeted therapy for at least some patients?
It's certainly possible. I mean, you can never rule anything out in these types of studies because, again, you can get fooled there too. Subgroup analysis, where you go back over the results of a big trial and try to find the particular group that responded well, subgroup analysis can really lead you down the garden path, because in a big enough trial, if you look at enough subgroups, some of them are going to look good just by chance. Honestly, you would be amazed. You would look through these things and you'll find that everyone who's a Scorpio or everyone who had Chinese food the week before, there, if you try enough variables, you will find these associations. However, the people at Genentech are very bright about this. They're looking at things that are plausible, like overexpression of VEGF or particular changes in that pathway that might really be relevant. They might find something, and I think that's exactly the way they should go. Avastin is not some sort of cure-all for cancer. There are no cure-alls for cancer. So some of the people who were so adamant about the FDA keeping this drug may well have been responding because of cases like this, where someone really did have a particular form of breast cancer that really did need Avastin to knock it down. I think it would be great if they could track these people down. I wish them a lot of luck in that. I really honestly think that we all might have been better off if that's what had been done at the very start. But the field is changing. People are just getting used to the idea that you're not going to have a cancer drug that treats this huge slice of the market. It's going to be tiny bits here and there.
I had one person tell me the other day, if you ever are diagnosed with cancer, don't go to the hospital that treats breast cancer or lung cancer. Go to the hospital that specializes in KRAS mutations or something like that.
That's where we're headed.
If you have your genome sequenced and that's where the mutation is, then go to the hospital or go to the specialists that know about that mutation and are fighting.
The problem is we don't know enough mutations yet, and we don't know enough about what these various mutations do, but, you know, we're piling up the knowledge.
Final thought, is this the kind of project that's going to take 5 years, 10 years, or who knows how long this will take and we've just started?
Oh, you mean the whole project of getting the cancer market personalized and tailoring drugs to them?
And trying to get this, I don't know what you'd call it, a complete checklist of the cancer mutations that you'd want to go through and attack.
Oh, 5 years, there's absolutely no possible way. 10 years, I think, is extremely optimistic. But somewhere in that order of magnitude, in the tens of years, yes, we will get down to the end of these things. There's only a finite number of them. There are probably only a certain number of ways that things can go wrong. We will eventually get to the end of the list. But the list gets more complicated every time you look at it. We realize that's finite, but finite numbers can still be pretty large.
That's right. Well, at least we're looking in the right places now and not treating cancer as if it was based upon the organ or when it's first discovered.
Exactly.
At the molecular
exactly.
level. Well, terrific. Derek, thanks very much, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
All right. Thanks very much. Enjoyed it.